It's episode 146 of Fancy Ramen. I'm Neil.
I'm Scott.
And we remembered to introduce ourselves this time.
Yeah, and we forgot Cookie in Texas.
But I don't think we've actually been introducing ourselves for like the past four episodes.
That's so. Okay. It's one of those only real listeners will remember this one. Only true fans will know our names.
But what have you been up to this week?
Outside of video gaming, Sierra and I picked up a new science fiction television show on Amazon Prime's like streaming platform called The Expanse. It's a it's sort of like a sci-fi drama. I'd say mostly drama. It's a sci-fi drama that has to do with essentially like a Cold War relationship that exists between Earth, Mars, and then what they call the Belt. At least I think that's how they classify it. And the Belt is essentially around or near the asteroid belt, and it might be Saturn as well. There are humans who are doing a majority of the like resource mining. And the resource that they're mining at this point is all of the ice that exists out there for water. It feels very similar to the like good political drama that exists within some of the Gundam animes. Like it all passes kind of a sci-fi smell test on the technology that they have is very it's like interesting, but none of it ever really feels like magic to any degree. You know how you have to toe that line in sci-fi where once you get to these technological developments like nanobots and shit like that, you can kind of do whatever you want because it allows you to make the case like, well, this is technology so far beyond anything that we can conceptualize. It operates in a very similar vein. The technology that exists in The Expanse and kind of how society is structured, I think it's still very familiar. It's still, I think, rudimentary enough that we can see, like, we can extrapolate the technology we have now into what exists within The Expanse and not find it too, like, incredulous or outrageous, which is cool.
So, would you say that this, in a way, is... It's more similar to like when I say Star Trek, I want you to kind of ignore the original series, but Star Trek minus some of the older gimmicks that they had brought into the series, like teleportation, phasers being set perpetually to stun.
Yeah, Star Trek in the sense that like they have 3D printing. I'm trying to think of a good example, or I guess I'd say the ships look like shit, right? They're still bulky, and they honestly look like something that that would be developed by NASA now and not by NASA in another like 50 years or some other space agency. Like, they're not that sleek. The spacesuits that they're wearing look a little bit more like exoskeleton suits, not the like super sleek fit with your like domed glass and like the really futuristic fancy space designs that we see in a lot of stuff.
Not it's like the Evangelion plug suit with a helmet.
Exactly. It's much more like a polygonal, like heavy duty just exosuit. You know, it has flashlights on it that look like they come off of your like higher brightness flashlights that you can buy at a like Home Depot or something. Like everything looks and feels very feasible and reasonable. The most interesting thing though is I think it takes place in the 23rd century. So there is generations of humans that have lived in the belt. And what makes it really interesting, and I don't know how often I've seen this explored in other sci-fi, is these people grew up their entire lives in low gravity. So people who are like native belters are like longer and like they're more elongated and they have like more brittle bones, similar to Joker from Mass Effect, the character that it's Seth Green, the character that Seth Green plays, except imagine him like stretched out a little bit further because there's nothing like keeping his body as tightly intact or together.
Sure, sure.
So it's kind of cool, like Belters, and then they also speak, what is it? They speak like a mashup language. This reminds me of like in Firefly, how they speak like half English, half Chinese phrases. Or at least I think it's supposed to be, it's supposed to seem Chinese. It doesn't have familiarity with any other language I know that they do in Firefly. But there's like Belter Krail, essentially. And they use it quite a bit. And it seems to actually, I can see that it pulls from the roots of like multiple languages, which also speaks to the like the multinational. Well, it's not even multinational anymore. I think it's like the Earth is just controlled by the UN. So it's just, it's like a cultural melting pot out on the, like out in space at that point. Like racial and national lines have dissolved quite a bit.
Okay, so so hold up.
Yeah, slow me down.
Do these Belters also have some innate power that is like pseudo telekinetic or psychic?
No, they get crushed by the gravity of real planets.
Okay.
So you can put them on hooks like a fish, and Earth will begin to like kill them with how strong its gravity is.
The fuck?
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. They become like essentially a almost a different, like, I don't want to say speciation, but just due to their exposure to like generations in space, there's like a widening cultural gap, or there's a widening gap between those who live on the planets and those who live out in the belt. It's also a big poverty versus it's a big class system clash as well. Like Mars is militaristic, Earth is diplomatic, but obviously like holds most of the like political capital and influential power. And then the Belters essentially slave away providing resources to Mars and Earth. And Mars and Earth are in a pseudo Cold War.
So you're telling me that like Earth is more for the privileged people and
Earth, I think it's even set up where like Earth and Mars are like a West-East conflict from the perspective of the West.
Okay. Like, and so
go ahead.
The Belters are basically these people that are, you know, might be building up resentment towards Earth and Mars over
time.
Both
of them, yeah. Yes.
Is there any big plot about crashing one of their satellites or colonies into Earth to destroy it?
What if I told you that one of the precipitating political events is that I'm excited to hear where you take this, but like I'll tell you that one of the inciting events right now is that the Belters are like forming or have formed a group called the OPA, which is essentially like a terrorist group or a resistance group to the influence and power of like Mars and Earth out in the Belter area, in the Belter region. And they're being like scrutinized by Earth for maybe gearing up for some terrorist attacks. And then a commercial ship in the belt gets destroyed by like stealth military technology. And so everybody's like, that technology could only come from Mars. And it's a ship that carries ice, which is, you know, a absolutely needed resource for all of the belt, and the planets, Earth and Mars. And so they're like, Mars is trying to intercede, or maybe they're friends with the OPA and the belt, or maybe Earth has set up like a phony, like false flag operation. Like there's so many theories going on right now in the show. And so everybody is in a Mexican standoff before this like Cold War event kicks off.
Technology that could only be for Mars, sort of like mobile suits that could only be made for
yeah, I'm telling you, like I think it's super it would be super intriguing to someone who's into the like politics of some of those Gundam shows, where it's just as much about the fighting robots as it is what the fighting robots are fighting about.
Sure.
This one just doesn't have the fighting robots, so instead, like, the best that they have is still essentially, like, naval warfare in space. But also I like to think about too, like the fact that Mars is an intermediary between the resources being harvested in the belt and Earth being essentially blocked by Mars. Like you could have this really interesting embargo scenario where it's like you can't, if Mars and Earth get into a standoff, I'm like waiting for them to explore the idea like Mars just blockades passage from Earth or any ships getting to Earth, and Earth, you know, dies from its own lack of like sustainability of life at this point. Because they baked in the whole like, oh, we fucked the Earth super hard with like climate change and whatnot. We're not fixing it. We're just grabbing more resources within our reach.
It feels to me like they have a very optimistic outlook of the future.
Right. I mean, they do, because there's still wealth and resources on Earth. Yeah. Like Earth is still alive and Mars is like trying to straight up terraform, I think. But they don't, they're also, there hasn't been any expression that the technology is really there yet either.
Sure.
It's interesting. I've enjoyed the show. It's been pretty good so far.
I might have to check it out. I do have like a little bit of a reluctance to start anything televised, but like any sort of series, unless it's something that Tiff and I can both agree to watch, since
right,
especially this year, since I don't have as much free time.
I kind of figured too that I wouldn't watch it if Sierra wasn't interested in it, but since both of us have liked it, we've continued.
Yeah, it's kind of, that becomes one of the qualifiers, right, when it comes to like taking in a form of media or an instance of media. It's like you kind of have to vet it out and see if your partner can also enjoy it. Otherwise, like, you have to have a set amount of time like for private enjoyment, which,
right, but you want to spend time together too.
Exactly.
And I should throw in one caveat that's going to mean a lot to you. I don't like any of the characters in this. Like, I think all of the there are some of them I'm like, I don't give a fuck about you. Like, I just don't care about you. Maybe you're supposed to be sympathetic, but I don't feel that way. And there are others where I'm like, this is a bad person. Or I feel like they trend towards bad person. And they're not maybe doing anything that's outright heinous or evil, though there's at least one I can think of who is, I definitely qualify as not a good person, or if they're going to like further describe their actions, because it seems like they're going to be protagonists for a bit, then there's a lot of nuance that we're going to need, at least embellished upon, not embellished upon, but like extended upon, and we need more context for me to be able to accept that this person is not like just a straight up villain who no one's calling out yet.
Well, so isn't it sort of like, it's sort of like watching a documentary, or maybe not a documentary, but like,
I think you might actually have something with that.
Like the first thing I thought of was Chernobyl. It's not like they're trying to paint characters as protagonists, or, you know, characters within like the literary sense. These are
people that
represent real human beings. You could almost take that same approach with this show, it sounds like.
Yeah, exactly. I think documentary, or even using something like Chernobyl, is a great way to frame it, because they're people. There's nothing that's super exaggerated about any of them. And there's nothing that is, there's nothing that makes, I think, the viewer feel any sort of particular like allegiance or association with each one over another. It feels like an objective view for a lot of it. Like, you understand where each one's coming from, and they're characterized with enough nuance that nothing feels like super clear cut.
Sure.
And so, yeah, you're much more of a passive observer. There's not necessarily any group I'd cheer for in any sense. It's so, more just the pursuit of like understanding the conflict and learning information that the characters do or don't know.
Would you say that the screen time between each character, or between like the main cast, is pretty split up in like a similar way to Game of Thrones?
in the sense that like Game of Thrones may have an episode that focuses on one or two heavily, but then they are in the background for an episode or two. I'd say they definitely have like, there's like three perspectives that we're getting the camera on. We're getting the perspective of a surviving commercial crew from the like inciting incident. We're getting a perspective on an Earth politician who is like right next to the reins of power. And then we're getting the perspective of a really greasy cop on private cop, by the way. Capitalism is run rampant in this universe, obviously. A private security or a privately owned cop on the Belter like colony or whatever, who is doing investigative work on someone who be related to the greater plot of this like inciting incident or attack that starts the show off. And as you can tell, I don't like Mr. Greasy Cop at all. And Miss UN politician is also maybe also not a character that I'm particularly fond of. But the ragtag like surviving commercial crew, their leader, who I don't even know if he's the leader. He's the protagonist in that group who gets the most screen time. I'm like, I could really take or leave this guy. And they're really trying to get me interested in him, telling me he's a man from Montana. You think that would be enough to sway my appreciation, but he's honestly kind of lame as well. It's like, it's his minor crew and the other characters who are working with these other protagonists that it's getting focused on that I think are the most interesting. And the overall interactions as well. Like, that's the big thing, is we're focused on individual people, but the thing of greatest interest, I think, to the viewer is actually what's going on around and above them, and not necessarily at the exact level that we're seeing from their perspective.
As Cookie would say, I can dig it.
Yeah, Cookie could dig it. But that's about it. Like, I haven't done much else outside of that. I'm getting ready for a big snowboarding vacation, so I've been packing up gear, getting ready to hit the mountain this upcoming week.
Well, while you've been experiencing a world post-climate change where they have to literally bring ice from the galaxy into Earth, I've been going down the other existential dread ladder, watching... The English title is Hozuki's Cool-Headedness, which it's an anime, by the way, if Hozuki was not obvious enough. But it's a show about essentially the second in command, the right hand man of Japanese hell. Mm-hmm. And in this anime, it's like it basically entirely, there's a few exceptions, takes place in all of the afterlives. So apparently, with this show, the reality is that there are several different hells. There's European hell, there's Japanese hell, there's heavens, and the idea is that it's essentially a way to fit all of these different characters together. So there's Satan, there's Beelzebub, there's Enma, King Enma, who is the person that passes judgment in Japanese hell on sinners. So if you don't go to heaven, you potentially go to hell, and then King Enma will tell you what you did and then sentence you to one of the like 276 different hells. And there are very, very specific hells in Japan, or Japanese hell. Like, there is an animal cruelty hell that if you like through your life hurt or tortured animals, you go to, and you get, you yourself get tortured for thousands, hundreds or thousands of years, I think, depending on like what your crimes were, by animals. And so there's a bunch of different hells in Japan that reflect what the sinner's, you know, crimes were or sins were. And depending on the severity of your crime, your age and so forth, you go to one of these many places. Now, Hozuki, the person that the anime, the titular character, being the second hand man, is kind of more of the, like, the, he kind of is not the shadow puppet. It's the opposite of that. He's in the shadows and probably actually has full control over everything. But he doesn't necessarily want that forward-facing role of being King Enma, one of the 10 kings of the Japanese underworld or Japanese hell. The show is absolutely a comedy. If you follow Hozuki, who is this guy who seems extremely straight-laced and business-only, but seems to actually carry a lot of personal feuds with him and likes to pull pranks on people, including his boss, King Enma. I probably don't have to get too far into specifics other than that it pulls a lot of content or material from Japanese mythology as well as other mythos, if you will. Like Satan comes to visit once and he gets his plan is to take over Japanese hell, but he decides pretty soon in from Hozuki that like this guy is too much for him. But it establishes fun little relationships between all of these different characters. You also have like very famous fairy tale or folklore characters like Momotaro making an appearance, and his three animals or companions. The most noteworthy thing though is that Hozuki is like such an enjoyable character because while he does seem to be very serious, he also has like an affectionate side. Like he can't, he loves it. It seems like he loves animals. And despite not really becoming friends with anyone, he usually treats kids really well. And the three animals that Momotaro
has. Do kids go to hell frequently?
They have an episode that's about these kids in hell. And the idea is basically that they go to hell for whatever reason, because maybe you can't live a virtuous life as a kid who actually knows like what the justification is, or maybe like maybe
instead
heaven...
of all dogs go to heaven, it's all kids go to hell. very interesting.
It sounds like to me that hell is where the majority of people end up going and heaven is for the select few.
Yeah.
And even then, if you're not destined for hell, there's also a likelihood that you just get reincarnated into the quote-unquote mundane world is what they call, like, our reality.
Earth, yeah.
But, like, all of the kids that show up in hell, it seems like, go to essentially this portion of hell, which is obviously not that bad or anything, where they build, like, block houses with these toys. And their version of hell is that demons, which are, you know, literally normal looking adults that just have horns sticking out of their head slightly, will come around and break their houses occasionally. But they're supposed to like do this as a way to train up their fortitude. And then eventually another mythological being from Japanese folklore that I don't recognize will come and take them back to be reincarnated. Again, like despite the fact that it's about hell, it's actually very, very humorous and it's kind of uplifting in different ways. But the three animals that Momotaro travels with fighting ogres, like in his mythos, it's a dog, a pheasant, and a monkey. Those three end up showing up really early in the series and plot devices, etc. They end up joining hell as demons or as punishers within the animal cruelty hell. So it's almost even like a sitcom where Hozuki just will find himself in a different situation or he'll be causing the situation because he is kind of mischievous and hilarity ensues. It's actually really good. It's especially educational in some of the Japanese folklore that I definitely wasn't familiar with until watching.
Interesting. I actually really like the sound of it. It sounds neat. I took a quick little Google search and I like how the art looks too. So
they do occasionally reference the original depictions and drawings of themselves and other characters within the show and
that's
like
neat.
Sometimes shit talk on it. That's basically all I've been doing outside of video games. But for video games, I don't have much to really discuss. I just finished, as of this morning, Hitman 2. And you may not remember, I certainly do. I really thought Hitman, you can kind of call it the reimagining of the series in either 2016 or 2017. I really love that game. I think upon its release, I don't think I played it immediately, but within the, you know, a couple months, I found it to be extremely charming, goofy, absolutely not serious at all, which I think is what the series really benefits from.
It's good to bring levity into murder.
And it's hilarious too, just like the ways you can off people, or the things you can do and decide not to off them too, mind you. I mean, you ultimately have to kill the person if you're going to get through the stage, but Hitman 2, though, is really a lot of the same thing. And as a result, I don't necessarily value it as much, but I can't really say anything bad about something that, like, I've really enjoyed. It feels a lot more like a really large DLC or a second season, if you want to call it that.
Oh, so this is the most recent hit. This is Hitman 2 post 2000. Reboot.
Yeah, Hitman 2 from 2019 or 18 or whatever.
2019. Okay. I thought you were talking about the Hitman 2 I was familiar with, and I was like, man, I don't know about that game.
Oh, like Silent Assassin or something?
Yeah, I tried playing it like a year and a half, 2 years ago with a big... Humble Bundles? I picked up a Humble Bundle that had a bunch of Hitman games on it. I tried it out and had a bad time. But I think that's partially limitation of the hardware at that point in time.
Well, yeah, and certainly, like, unless you have a nostalgia, a lot of those games do not age as well.
That's right, yeah. Not every game can be Halo Combat Evolved.
And to be quite frank, Hitman 1 and 2, 2016 or 17 and 2018, 19, whatever years it is, these most recent games really don't control that well. And I don't think they're going to age well in that regard. But because the game is really not an action title or meant to be played in that way, it's right. Kind of more of an elaborate puzzle game where you have mechanical elements to it too. And it kind of adds some of the fun and hijinks to the game when you accidentally hit the wrong button and suddenly decide to punch out a guy in front of like an entire crowd.
Yeah.
Now, granted,
it's hard to think of how that works in context, though. I do appreciate when you make mistakes in context, like you miss a shot and alert a guard in Metal Gear Solid or whatever. But I have a harder time appreciating it when I accidentally hit a button like that, because I think in the moment, like, Agent, is it 47?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. Agent 47's not going to choose to just, like, outright cold cock somebody, you know, in a crowd in almost any way I can think of.
I mean, I think, though, that Hitman kind of gets a pass because the AI is so stupid.
Yeah, I guess I have seen people create like electrified water puddles and then just stack up bodies repeatedly.
Like,
so
you can do something heinous, like knocking someone out in a crowd of people and then run two rooms away. And even though like everyone in the room you punch someone in sees you and knows that you are not who you seem to be, whatever disguise you are using. That mm-hmm. So even though that costume, or excuse me, disguise is compromised, as they would put it, it's only really compromised in that one room. So you can still walk around and do more or less everything you otherwise couldn't do.
You just can't be a milkman in that spot anymore.
Exactly. And so you just go and get a different disguise, run back, and do the thing that you were supposed to do. Granted, there are times where like you have a specific costume or disguise and you're using it for a very specific story beat mission. But so if you mess up there, you lose out on it. But like the auto saves are all pretty frequent enough, and I never feel necessarily too bad save scumming in that game. Only because sometimes I'll just save and do a thing that I would not normally do, but I want to see what happens. Like, what happens if I drop this chandelier on top of a bunch of innocent people? Let's find out.
They get mad. Who would have thought?
But, I mean, overall, really enjoyable. The big hit for me is that, yet again, they decide to end on a cliffhanger. The story does go in directions that I really don't care about Hitman's story. Like, didn't care about it through all of the old games, didn't care about it in Hitman 1, didn't care about it in Hitman 2, the 1 and 2 being the more recent ones.
Yeah.
But I kind of got interested when they pulled something that I kind of saw coming but didn't think they would have the guts to do. It's not like a big twist or anything. It's just, oh, they're going in this direction. That's interesting. But then they decide to pull a cliffhanger at the end, which is what they did with Hitman 1. And then IO Interactive went into legal problems. And it was kind of up in the air as to whether or not a Hitman 2 was even going to be made, or a Season 2. That, I think, technically got put on hiatus or canceled at one point.
And right. I remember reading the news about that.
And yet again, they decide that they're going to end on a cliffhanger, which feels really shitty when they've already had the real possibility of the series dying. I feel
Wouldn't
like
it'd be great though if it's like a dare, essentially, like, you can't kill us now, we got to finish this story.
I mean, I honestly don't understand. Oh, no, I do. I do understand why it took so long, because they had to, they did have all of those financial problems, and they had to separate from Sony and still retain Hitman and however that happened. Like, good job on you. If it was Sony's graces that allowed it to happen, whatever, I don't care. But that was like a 3-year gap. And part of my issue here is that I don't necessarily think Hitman 2 should have taken 3 years. Again, the complications, of course, add to that. But who actually knows when a quote-unquote Hitman 3 or Season 3 is going to actually show up?
If it's
even going to show up at all. Right. I really wish they had ended it in some satisfying way, as opposed to, hey, we got the guy, he's going to give us the information, now we have more targets. Let's literally end the game revealing kind of a somewhat important plot point with the two characters riding a boat off into the frontier or the distance. It's like that is the shittiest ending. Maybe not the shittiest ending, but that's a pretty bad ending. Like, outside of having three choices and waking up in a pile of rubble after choosing the red choice, there's not much worse you can get to having like a cliffhanger that potentially will have no resolution.
I mean, I think it could have been done with a little bit more delicate. It could have been done a little more delicately than having pre-order Hitman 3 now, right after the credits roll.
There is a commercial inside of the game for a DLC pack.
Oh, no.
And I don't even know. It might have been one that was released between 1 and 2 or post 2.
Mm-hmm.
But like, as much as I kind of wanted to investigate more into it, I just felt it was sort of, I don't know, weird. Like,
it's like, it can be funny if they do that, but it's still tacky. It's going to be tacky either way. You can take humor in it,
right?
Or you cannot. But that does it. That whether you find it funny is not going to change the fact that you're like that you perceive it as tacky or I don't know, a little, like, it's going to trigger some sort of discomfort in you either way. It's just, do you wave it away with humor or decide that, oh, that's not really that funny, that's kind of sad? I don't know.
I don't even think it's related to the main story now that I look it up.
Well, I would like to prod you for just a second on another DLC that you saw that got you very excited. And then you looked into it, I think, for an additional 5 minutes and immediately cooled off on that excitement. I'm, of course, talking about the first announcement of Three Houses DLC for Fire Emblem Three Houses.
Maybe we should recap the exchange we had here. It started with me finding the video and sending it to you extremely excitedly. And
That's
then at
right.
some point, as you looked into it more, I also did as well and found that the comments were reflecting, or I think it was actually from Nintendo themselves, either on their YouTube or whatever, Twitter, but they were saying that this was not a fourth or fifth, quote unquote, story branch, but instead sort of like a side quest thing that you could probably participate in This is me extrapolating now.
Probably during the five-year gap.
Either during the five-year gap or just before or something like that. But definitely at the start of, you know, the first half of the game.
Yeah.
And my excitement diminished a lot because, as we've talked before, what I want from Three Houses is a path that feels like it was actually finished.
Like they did with, what is it, Birthright and Conquest.
Yeah.
Because that had a golden path, from what I understand.
And neither... So I haven't played the golden path in that, but the... I did.
My sister did, and that's... I'm basing this all off of her info, but I do believe she gave essentially the review that it was like, if you weren't happy that someone lost in Conquest and that someone else lost in Birthright, then you can just be happy with part three.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And that, I want that. If I'm going to play like a power fantasy RPG, I want there to be a happy ending for all parties.
You want absolute power, yeah.
Like, I and not necessarily even out of the desire for self, like domination or like total power itself, but just to be able to bring happiness to all of these characters that really all want the same thing, but don't know how to talk. Because that's essentially that's the problem in Three Houses. We don't know how to fully talk about our problems.
And honestly, it was sort of the problem in Conquest and Birthright, except it was like one party being gaslit about their father emperor being an inhuman, like demonic blob, and the other party being like unable to articulate that your father is an inhuman, demonic blob. Like, it's possible. Both of these, like the previous Fire Emblem game and then this one, I think the reason that we also want a golden route is because it seems totally possible. It seems attainable in the power fantasy that exists within the game.
Right.
Yeah, it doesn't feel like you're fighting impossibility. I would just very quickly like to get the timestamps for 7:21 a.m. I get a ping on the general Slack chat from Neil. Hot damn, all caps. I was at first skeptical, but after seeing the trailer, I am pumped for the new DLC for Three Houses. Jump to 7:30 a.m. timestamp. Oh, wait. Might not be a full path.
Yep.
And of course, I also noted that, what was it? I was joking about the DLC Three Houses option, but this brings me into one other thing to mention that is sort of tangentially related to Three Houses. We just found out that the final Smash champion is going to be another blue-haired Fire Emblem character with a sword. But Sakurai realizes that maybe we were going to give him a little bit of shit for having a Fire Emblem character with blue hair and a sword because we already have five of those, depending on how you choose Robin's coloration, maybe six. But they literally leaned into the joke and said, hey, not only do you have a sword, you also get a bow, a spear, and an axe. So be happy with that, okay? And truly, I found that delightful. Like, I think when I started watching it, I told Sierra, I was like, I can't believe that they're doing this. And then I got about halfway into the video, and I'm like, I'm very amused and convinced that this was an okay move for them to do this. They sold me on the character with how heavily they leaned into, like, haha, we get it. You said no more Fire Emblem characters, but here's another Fire Emblem character. Enjoy.
Yeah, and I almost feel like it's redundant. I'm sure this point might have been brought up before, but this was going to happen because so many people were so fucking hyped about Fire Emblem Three Houses on its release.
Absolutely. Like, including us. I mean, there's... We are the pot calling the kettle black here. We all acknowledge that we were hyped for Three Houses. I absolutely was. And I think we all knew that it was also going to not like necessarily live up to our expectations. And yet somehow it really did for me.
Yeah, it still does. I'm not saying the game's bad or anything. Like, I really, really enjoyed it. And if it weren't for a few other titles this year, it would be in my top three, or it's probably in my top five. It's definitely in my top 10 of 2019.
Yeah,
but
go ahead.
You can't underestimate the power of word of mouth and hype. like, this game was getting people from all facets of video game genres in on it, whether it was people that were fans of RPGs, people that were fans of visual novels, mostly in that case Japanese players, or people that just had never played a turn-based tactical RPG before. Like, I had coworkers at work that I didn't realize even played video games that were talking about Three Houses. It's you look like someone that probably goes to Sunday school instead of ever playing video games. That's a weird statement, I know, but...
But just so many people who've gone to Sunday school have let you down when you talk video games with them.
No, it was almost like someone I never even would have pegged to play this weird Japanese game where you end up becoming romantically involved with your students.
Right.
But don't worry, it's been 5 years. It's fine, man. They grew quite a bit. It was a weird eye-opening moment, I guess, that any game could get that much attention outside of like the main titles that Nintendo has.
Right. Fire Emblem with that game reached so far outside of its usual bubble of players.
And as soon as that happens, yes, that just guaranteed that Byleth was going to be a DLC character. I'm actually surprised it wasn't, what's her face? Edelgard. Yeah, it could have been her even.
I mean, I was crossing my fingers for Hilda the whole time, but we can't all win.
Not the favorite waifu, I don't think.
I think Hilda actually, or the voice actress for Hilda, or voice actor for Hilda, actually did some of this, like, did some of the dialogue or the narration for that Smash announcement. I am not entirely sure, but I could have sworn that was a familiar voice I heard. They were talking about the release of Byleth.
I didn't even realize. Sorry, listened in Japanese.
That's my big crush. I don't know why, but I thought all of the Golden Deer, minus like Ignatz, were like just phenomenal characters overall. Really, really enjoyed them.
Ashen Wolves looks interesting enough. I like the character designs and so forth, and like I don't know why it's a thing, but I do appreciate that who I'm guessing is the house lead is docked out or decked out in eyeshadow and eyeliner as well.
I like that their relic is going to be brawler's gloves or gauntlets, I should say. I think I'm almost certain that their regalia or what, I don't know what they call it. I can't even remember now. Their ancient relic weapon is, I think, going to be brawler's gauntlets, it looks like.
That's crazy. I mean, it goes to show you, but I didn't even realize. I don't remember the regalia or anything from the other houses. It's weird because
there's the axe, the spear, and the bow.
Okay.
Are also Byleth's side B or neutral B. That was also cool. I thought that Byleth gets to use all of the like crest weapons.
It's kind of surprising that I remember so little of that game given this amount of time.
Right, we put in over 100 hours apiece. Even Cookie had to have put in at least 60 something to finish.
Because he finished the church ending, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Scott, what have you been playing?
I finished Disco Elysium. I can't remember if we talked about that on the pod last time.
Yeah, we haven't.
Close to finishing. I wrapped it up. I was right last time on the podcast. I said, I think I'm really close to the end. I honestly, had I another 45 minutes, the game would have been over. So I really did get very close to wrapping it up.
The ending
is abrupt.
It's abrupt, and it further supports the theory that the game was kind of rushed at the end of development.
Yeah, there's no way I see them doing that without some sort of pressure. Just because it was it was so out of left field. Like, it didn't feel like anything actually got wrapped up, even though I think I did most, if not all, of the work to wrap up the case. Like, I'm missing the probably closing the church storyline, and that's it. Like, everything else really got taken care of.
The church storyline doesn't really seem so... You know, I don't think any of the side quests really felt that gratifying to me at the end of the day.
What about Crypto's zoological hunting?
Okay, that one does to some extent, but it actually becomes a main quest if you want to think of it that way. But even then, you don't get to fulfill your end of the bargain, which is informing the cryptozoologists about your findings. So you don't even get the gratification of, hey, look what we found.
Right. Like that, you get to queue up at best the action to do it in like the epilogue of the game.
Yep. And
you just get to assume it gets done.
Assuming like your car doesn't break down in like a drunken rampage because you accidentally replaced your water with liquor or something. The ending, though, like, even though it definitely feels rushed, I think it was, and it's hard for me to tell whether or not I'm giving it more credit because I know it was probably rushed and, you know, low on funds at the time. But it certainly does like a good job of making me, or giving me at least some level of like importance on the rest of the game. Because when, you know, as we stopped last week, you were on the island, you had just talked to the cryptid or interacted with the cryptid, I guess.
The Insolidian phasmid.
You proceed to, for whatever reason, think it's a good idea to just leave the guy in his catatonic state on the island, which I'm going to chalk that up to like, all right, we're not going to code in how to have one more person follow us or do something that would imply or indicate we're taking him with us because that's going to take too much time.
I applaud that they did that and then also said, well, there's no way three people would fit on a boat. Are you crazy?
I just was like, whatever. It's a shitty boat, I guess. And the two characters leave the island to go back to the city and do whatever it is that they need to do to get him off the island, only to be interrupted by the disguised pair of police officers along with the psychiatrist or psychologist of the police department or something that had happened to be showing his son a freaking mural for 5 days straight.
Stupid fucking vacation. I think we can all agree the son did not appreciate that.
But
I don't care how much you love your dad.
And then it suddenly becomes the Chrono Trigger trial where you get judged upon all of your actions at the town, the Millennial Festival or whatever it was in Chrono Trigger.
Right.
And they tell you it was bad to eat that person's chicken dinner.
It was.
Yes, it was bad. But
let's not sound like above the law here. We did eat someone's chicken dinner.
I mean, you did. No, I totally did my first time too. But yeah, like they basically, you get to talk about everything you've done, every side quest you've completed, and then they tell you whether it was a good thing or a bad thing. And Kitsuragi also talks about the nature of your character, and in my case, the fact that I think I might have been like a moralist, but then something else, which seemed contradictory, but whatever. And then you invite Kitsuragi, potentially, into your police department after your colleagues are like, okay, I guess we're going to have him on the police force still because he does a good job.
No. Oh, yeah. Our character. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Harry. Did you end up keeping your name? Did you discard your name?
I kept it. Did you discard it for the crazy name?
No, I didn't discard it. Oh, yeah. The crazy name. I am on this second playthrough actually going to discard his name of Harry Dubois. But it's just, I do like how many opportunities there are for you to just be like, that's not my name. I don't want that name. That's not for me. Or just throw something else out. Like, I have a terrible, I have a terrible crazy name instead that I'm sticking to. Like, I don't know why I appreciate that so much, but I really do want to see if you play the game all the way through, if you're just like, it's not Harry anymore.
I'm curious. You should tell me how different you can make things be if you do a second playthrough.
That's really what I'm gunning for, is trying to deviate as far as possible. No more sad cop, no more nice cop. I'm going to be like drugged out psycho cop.
You mean drugged out, not a cop?
Yeah, exactly. Not even a cop. That's my copo type, is not a cop.
I could see some interesting dialogue trees happening as a result of that. My only concern, though, is that really it doesn't feel like there's much that's going to change through like the second half of the game. I did read
it
into
seems
a
like
few
yeah
things.
You're gonna stumble into all of the like resolutions regardless at that
I
point.
Kind of have a feeling that's what happens, because that's who your character is. Because as much as you want to make your character be a certain thing, really at the end of the day you're still this dude that's apparently so good at his job that he has a task force, and his task force fucks the hell off because you tell him to, and who
you
actually
still solved
knows?
The case. Yeah, I mean, that's I like that they establish that. There are like two things I really like. One of them, just quickly deviating back to the copo types. I don't know why I found the copo types so satisfying, just existing, the different types that there were, and feeling like you fit into a niche of one or two. But it was just like, okay, this is a role-playing game where I don't get to choose to be a barbarian or a rogue or something. So I just get to be a different type of cop, or try and reject the label of cop overall. And I don't know why I found that so charming, but it was fun. And I wish more games had some sort of just like, here's a template that we think you are. And your response either being like, yeah, I think that is me, or nah, fuck that. That's not me. I don't want to be that at all. I need to change up how I'm playing.
I just kind of wish that there was something other than the ending that really seems to reflect upon. Because I don't know if there is any consequence of becoming a sad cop or a moralist or a communist. Because even if I wasn't a communist and I opted out of every title, I still have the ability to choose all of those responses when people ask me questions.
That's right. Yeah, I agree. I think that's true that it doesn't let you actually blockade yourself out of a lot of things outside of skill checks. While it would be interesting if you like deviated, if you didn't choose certain dialogue options in the beginning, or you even rejected those dialogue options or choices, that the game would start to lock you out of them. Just like, okay, you're definitely not down with communism. All of these pro-communist options are gone. Like,
right.
You've demonstrated that's not for you, and you're not changing your mind in this short period. But I do like... Oh, go ahead.
There's a game which is very, very different from this one, and I do not recommend you play it or anything. It's just... I want to bring it up real quick. It's called Growlancer. I think it's 4. And in the game, your character is a mute-ass motherfucker, just like a lot of JRPGs. But the... Well, mute within the regard of there's no script choices. Or no script for the protagonist, only your answers. But yeah, what made the game interesting is that in the background, there's a bunch of different stats that were like, they were essentially the stats were like polar in nature. So okay, you could either have
introvert,
a negative
extrovert,
or a positive. Yeah. Yeah. And if you would do a lot of actions, it's basically like, each choice would have a requirement based upon some of these stats, like kindness or whatever the opposite of kindness is, or humility and smugness. And there were like maybe 5 or 6 different stats for these, just for your character's personality. And the more you played him in one of those directions, the less often you would get the choice to do the other option. So if
they have similar results? Like,
not always. So, I only like played that. The game once, but I think like you can talk your way out of battles and stuff based upon like what your stats are, what your personality is like, and you can sometimes align yourself to people if you happen to like have the right stat for that person, or you make them into enemies.
But it's not working on the line like you're personable, so you talk to people and like talk them down from an engagement. But the same way you can be super intimidating, opposite spectrum of personable, and then just like threaten people out of the same exact fight. Whereas like
it might
flavor,
be,
but the same outcome.
It might be that there are two different situations. There's one person that can only be intimidated in one place. And then in another part of the game, there is a person that would not be intimidated, but would handle someone that is diplomatic, maybe.
Okay, yeah.
But, I mean, I don't even know if it's necessarily avoiding conflict or combat that necessarily motivates you into becoming the character, or becoming a specific type of character. I think it was more about the storytelling aspect of it, that, like, and maybe there had like, an element of you affecting the ending. I never finished it, but it kind of felt like what Disco Elysium was also, you know, attempting or accomplished, which is you basically are making the character into who you want the character to be. You can make the person kind, you can make the person ruthless. And I almost felt that Disco Elysium would have benefited. Granted, it probably had to be a longer game, but if, as you said, like you pushed for communist ideas, for instance, that maybe capitalist or free trade ideas or choices slowly became less and less frequent, or just you were gated out of those choices once you passed a certain threshold.
And the developers making a like background moves to do that, as opposed to in this game, it's really like confronting you and pushing you.
Yeah, and
alternate ideas.
Well, and I would absolutely bet that you could become a communist and then become a capitalist and have both archetypes in this game.
Agreed. Yeah. And somehow put those two ideas into your thought cabinet, like the super capitalist and the super communist side by side. And so, then apparently the stat bonuses, and that would be fun if the stat buffs and debuffs essentially canceled out for a net neutral.
I don't even remember what. I know some of them would give you like benefits based upon like committing certain actions would improve upon your morale. I wonder if the capitalist benefit was anytime you buy an item or sell an item, you increase
your morale.
I'm taking part in the system.
I mean, there was stuff that just gave you money outright for like when you performed an action, you just got money for it, which was interesting.
Which is like,
I had
that sounds like Deadly Premonition. Like
it doesn't make
today.
Any sense, but I liked it.
I got my shave on, so the FBI paid me money. Again, though, like I feel like the ending did give me some sort of weird level of satisfaction being told outright that, like, hey, you fucked up a lot this time. Like, I don't know if they
but
told
you,
you how
it.
Much you fucked up, but they said I fucked up by letting Classie go and letting Ruby go.
Mm-hmm.
Which is like, well, okay, I guess I don't know what maybe they would say I screwed up by taking in both of them, or maybe there would be negative side effects for taking in both of them. I don't know if there's a way to arrest Ruby. What happened with Ruby for you?
I just got a really bad roll when I was trying to convince her. Like, I had like an 80% chance to essentially like talk her down.
Oh, and she offed herself?
Yeah, and I lost and she shot herself in the face. It was one of those things where I was like, yes, I got this. Like, I'm perfectly set up for it. It's, you know, a part of the it's a red check. And then I rolled like a 3, and it was like, oof. I had to roll like a 5 to get it. It was frustrating, but I was just like, well, shit, there's no going back, because I'm not going to save scum in that game. It feels like it really defeats the point. I do like the second point that I was getting to, that I think this is the time to round back to, is I do like how no matter what you do, your reputation is the can opener. Like, it remains. No matter what approach you take in this, like, you are stumbling towards the truth, whether you're doing a good job as a cop and that's how you're getting there, or you're just like literally trying to walk in the opposite direction of the conclusion and getting lost and finding your way at it anyway.
which we kind of maybe lightly talked upon last week, but I tried to avoid very specific things, I guess, but it's the fact that Harry has this innate sense of knowing the answer immediately. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you get it from different skills, but I got it from Inland Empire, where mm-hmm. when you analyze the body and start talking to the body, you find out that the body was like, it was killed by love, or did killed by communism and did in by love.
Mm-hmm.
Every single time there's some weird, oblique, or cryptic feeling that you get in that game, it turns out to be 100% true. Which
it's just, yeah, it's uninterpretable at the moment.
Yeah, it's hard for me to think whether or not I like it or dislike it, because at the end of the day, like, this is a terrible mystery game, but it's not really necessarily trying to be a mystery game.
Yeah, it's way more about the story overall.
But you're still playing a mystery game. And that is what maybe I fault the game for the most, if I have to.
I think a second playthrough would really solidify both of our feelings on it. And that's why I'm going to try and do it over time, because it's a long enough game that there are other things to do. But yeah. I really do want to see, like, okay, if I take the opposite direction, how much do I appreciate what's going on, especially with something like Inland Empire, where it's like, you're giving me a bunch of like esoteric shit that's going to make sense later. But now as a player, if I didn't have the background knowledge, I'd just be like, huh, well, I've got a hunch and I don't understand what it means, but it's pointing me in this direction. And maybe seeing that second time around should be interesting, because I'll know what it's trying to do, most likely.
Well, and so I'm scared here of one thing, and that's, like, I played an Inland Empire heavy character. It's not that I even built into it so much, but because my psych or whatever was so high to begin with.
Yeah, you just had great base stats for it, and you triggered it a lot, I assume.
So if I were to play it again, I would be going brute force, and my fear is that Shivers is actually going to end up triggering a bunch of the things that Inland Empire did. Because yeah. we did have this experience with Clausier when Volition was telling me, hey, everyone's fucking compromised.
Mm-hmm.
Don't listen to yourself anymore. It turned out to be a different skill for you that did the same thing. Maybe just spoken differently.
I think it was an intellect skill, though. But yeah, it was... It told me the same thing, but because my volition was so miserably low, I know that it wasn't volition that gave me that hint.
Which leads me to another thought, and that is, I wonder if this game has bullshit multiverse functions going on. One of the quote-unquote possible dark history points to your character is that he may or may not be a corrupt cop, which it sounds like for the two of us was not the case. I'm wondering yeah. if you are a bad and dirty cop and, you know, getting money from people, if it turns out, quote unquote, that you actually
you take
were
these routes. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm curious if there is a level of that involved,
if not,
that
I
the reality
the
changes.
Red herring. Right. If not, I love the red herring where you're just like, am I a dirty cop? And they're like, no, you're a bad cop, but like, you're not working for a drug organization.
At least you weren't before, but maybe now.
Or maybe they're gaslighting you in front of Kim. Yeah. And they're like, no, of course not. We're not. Kim, come join our precinct. And then, you know, we don't get the epilogue where Kim ends up in the river.
And to go to that real quick, that was another thing that I did really like, the way that they illustrated Kim to be such a good detective / cop that even the people a part of your task force like looked up to him and were very respectful of him. As soon as you invite Kim, like everyone in your team, or maybe not everyone, but I remember people being like, oh, wow, Kim Katsuragi.
I mean, even I think the character's name Jean-Pierre, who obviously hates your guts or is just sick of your shit at this point, is like, it would be excellent to have Kim on the force. And I was just like, yes, he's in.
Did you notice that, or did you know that if you did not, I don't know if I want to say this or not. What I can say, this is me reading because I wanted to see if there was a possible way for like major deviation, especially in the end game, which again, definitely felt like the bottleneck at the end of what is otherwise at least like different conclusions leading to one outcome. But there is a possibility that you do not go to the island with Kim with you.
Right. You can have him send the body, for instance, and then go to the island same day.
Well, do you know what would happen if you don't get Kim to, you don't tell Kim that someone's about to shoot him or whatever?
Oh, shit. You can lose Kim altogether.
I don't know if he dies,
but maybe that's a possibility. He gets taken out of the game.
And so, are you interested in doing that?
Oh, it's going to feel bad to hurt Kim, but I really do want to push the game's boundaries, so I probably will.
Then I will not tell you where that leads, because I think it's interesting, but I can't give my opinions on it at all, because I don't want to necessarily ruin anything or, you know, shock you or ruin the surprise of it.
But it's going to be one of those moments where, you know, you choose to blow up Megaton in Fallout 3, and you're like, I know this was the wrong thing to do, but I had to see what would happen. And then you're confronted with that smoking pit in the ground, and you're just like, man, I really fucked up. This save is trashed.
I mean, Fallout 3 had the problem, not to go off on a rant so much. Maybe this is me and the reason why I want a golden ending in Three Houses, but it seems like there's no suitable option in Fallout 3 between those two places. Obviously, that tower is full of assholes, right? The tower full of people, including Mr. Burke, who want you to blow up Megaton. But who's to say that there are also not a lot of people in that tower that are just guilty by association? And it seems like the option of either blowing up Megaton or introducing mutants into the building or whatever else you can do to kill off everyone in the building, like, those are the resolutions.
So well, there's the 100%, like, the you need 100% speech skill to just convince every single resident to let ghouls in. But it's nearly impossible. There is technically a happy middle road where you make them confront their racism and also don't blow up another town.
Which you're probably not going to get unless you...
You kind of have to game the whole inner workings of it to make it work, but I've done it.
So,
but it's like you essentially ignore the tower or that quest line until the very end of the game, and then you come back. You're like, hey, by the way, you can all get along.
Oh, can we? Oh, I guess we can. You are level 54.
Yeah, all right. Exactly.
Which doesn't feel like a good game design to me. So ultimately,
it's not.
Because it's in the early portion of the game, you're presented with those two options, which encourages me to just not do it, to not even mess with the story quests and move on.
Yeah.
And that is kind of like the Kuno drug dad quest, which I never even approached because I did not want to interact with Kuno and I did not want to do something illegal in that game.
Yeah.
But anyways, Disco Elysium. I talked a lot of shit, but that's primarily because I felt that that game could be more than what it was.
Right.
And it's an indie game too. Like, let's not forget that I enjoyed it a lot and probably more than a handful of AAA games I played this year. So
right, we're putting pressure on a super small team with a super small budget. So.
I do really wish, though, that people that liked this game would consider playing other games that are tangential to it. Like, because it's very similar, like Planescape Torment or Divinity Original Sin 2. It's not a game that I necessarily enjoyed as much, but there's absolutely value there for a lot of people. There's a lot of isometric RPGs that are very story-rich. Out there, and I hope Disco Elysium opens up the idea of people playing those games, as well as games like visual novels too, that I would say offer even more opportunity for story and character development. I think that about wraps up everything.
I would agree. Fancy Ramen Podcast. You can email us, send comments at podcast@fancyramen.com.
You can also subscribe on YouTube. Be one of like the zero people that watch the YouTube video as opposed to one of the 10 people that watch or listen to the podcast feed. We also stream on twitch.tv. Fancy Ramen TV is one username. That's where I stream, as well as potentially groups at some point. Cookie Skimilk, that's CUKISKMILK, is where Cookie streams, the member that is not present with us today. Artie Strongman, one of the original members of the podcast and occasionally will come on, is at Artie_Strong_Man. And Jay Frey All Day, another old member. Do you know what Artie Strongman is a reference to?
No, I don't.
And that's Keith, by the way. It's apparently a Pete and Pete reference.
I don't even know what Pete and Pete is.
What the fuck, man?
I'm younger than you guys.
Are you like 20? Are you 18?
I'm 27.
All right, let's wrap up this episode. Immediately afterwards, you're going to listen to the Pete and Pete theme song, and everything will be right in the world.
Episode 146, Neil Feels Old. Tell your friends and family about our podcast. We'd love for you to share. Until next week, guys.
Incoming games of the year.
Bye.